Great to be back at Antonin Scalia Law School. My name is Bruce Kobayashi, and I've been a faculty member here since 1992. I'm currently on leave and serving as the director of the Bureau of Economics. And in that capacity, it's my honor and pleasure to be able to introduce our opening speaker for our two morning panels on antitrust and labor markets, Professor Alan Krueger. Professor Krueger holds a joint appointment at the Department of Economics and the Woodrow Wilson School as the Bendheim Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton University. It's a particularly appropriate choice to open our labor market sessions, having published widely on the economics of education, unemployment, labor demand, income distribution, social insurance, and labor market regulation. In addition to a long list of academic articles, he has published multiple books, including his co-authored book with David Card on Myth and Measurement, The New Economics of the Minimum Wage, and a book that I have put on my reading list, Rockonomics, How Music Explains Everything About the Economy. Especially since I saw in the blurb that he interviewed the manager of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Professor Krueger has served in the government. He was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisor and a member of President Barack Obama's cabinet from 2011 to 2013. Just prior to that, he served as Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy and as a chief economist for the U.S. Department of Treasury from 2009-2010, and way back in the day when we were all younger, he's still younger than I am, he was chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor. So Alan certainly knows a lot about labor and public policy. He's held high positions in the American Economic Association, served on the executive committee, won numerous awards, too lengthy to mention. Here's his resume. It's double-sided. But let's give a warm welcome to our opening speaker, Alan Krueger.
Thanks very much for that generous introduction, and especially for plugging my book, which will be out in May, but you may especially be interested in the book by Flea of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, which covers the first 18 years of his life, which will be out around the same time as mine. I'm concerned maybe competition. I want to thank the FTC for inviting me and for holding this set of hearings. It's really an impressive set of topics that are being discussed by a very impressive set of researchers and others. What I thought I would do is give an overview of how I see competition and lack of competition in the labor market. I think this is a particularly appropriate time to have this discussion. Research in labor economics has been growing very quickly on non-competitive practices and on the non-competitive workings of labor markets. I think this is a topic which is very important. I think it's one in which the evidence is still evolving. We face similar kinds of challenges in the labor market as industrial organization economists face in looking at product markets in terms of defining the scope of a market. In fact, in many ways, I think it's more difficult in the labor market because every individual is unique. That said, I think there's a growing body of evidence which suggests that the go-to model of the labor market, which has historically been one of perfect competition, is probably not the best model to use in many situations. In a perfectly competitive model of the labor market, bargaining power is completely irrelevant because wages are determined by the external forces of supply and demand. Firms just passively accept whatever the market wage is. In many applications, I think it is more appropriate to model the labor market as imperfectly competitive. And Bob Topel arrived just in time. Subject to monopsony-like effects, collusive behavior by firms, surge frictions, and surpluses that are bargained over. As a result of these labor market features, I think it's often more appropriate to view firms as wage setters or wage bargainers rather than wage takers. This perspective can explain many well-documented phenomena in the labor market, such as the high variability in pay for workers with seemingly identical skills who work in different industries or in different firms, the lack of evidence that minimum wage increases reduce employment, and the reluctance of firms to raise wages despite facing vacancies. Now, I've noticed that many economists are reluctant to accept the idea that markets are manipulable, that firms or traders have some power over prices and wages. When I worked at the US Treasury Department in 2009 and 2010, and I had the opportunity to work with some of the best finance economists in the world who were on leave to help during the financial crisis, my colleagues thought it was inconceivable that foreign exchange markets or LIBOR could be manipulated. After all, these are the largest and most liquid markets in the world. Only later did we learn that several traders have been convicted of colluding on exchange rates and that LIBOR was totally rigged. Interestingly, the people who I worked with who came from the markets, who actually had experience trading, thought this was quite the norm. Now, one economist who thought that labor markets are imperfect and subject to manipulation was Adam Smith. In The Wealth of Nations, Smith wrote, quote, "Employers are always and everywhere in a sort of tacit but constant and uniform combination not to raise the wages of labor above the actual rate. To violate this combination is everywhere a most unpopular action and the sort of reproach to a master among his neighbors and equals. Smith ridiculed naysayers who doubted that employers colluded as, quote, ignorant of the world as of the subject. And then in full conspiracy mode, he added, quote, we seldom indeed hear of this combination because it is the usual, and one may say the natural state of things, which nobody ever hears of. Now, you don't have to look too far to find evidence of the conspiracy that Adam Smith warned about. In an ongoing FTC case involving physical therapists in Dallas and Fort Worth, the language rings very similar to what Adam Smith wrote about, only it's been more modernized with texting. The owner of one physical therapy company wrote another, yes, I agree, I'll do it with you. U was spelled U, not Y-O-U, and do it was referring to jointly agreeing to lower wages. Now, I'll return to some other cases involving collusion in the job market. Broadly speaking, there are two varieties of economic models that give employers some discretion over wage setting. The first, pioneered by Joan Robinson, is a static monopsony model where there's a single employer who faces an upward-sloping labor supply curve. This could be easily extended to a small number of employers, oligopsony, and it could be extended to Smith-like situations where employers jointly collude to suppress pay below the competitive rate. The second class of models, which were pioneered by Ken Burdett, Dale Mortensen, Chris Pissarides, Peter Diamond, and extended recently by Alan Manning, rests on search frictions. And there are a variety of different types of search models, but basically it takes time and effort for workers to search for job openings and for firms to search for workers. As a consequence, if a firm pays a little less than the going wage, it would not lose all of its workers or find it impossible to hire new ones. In fact, there is no single going wage in these models, but a range of plausible offers that firms could make or bargains that firms and workers can strike. As a practical model, practical matter, both classes of models are equivalent to assuming that the labor supply curve to a firm is upward sloping instead of infinitely elastic. Firms would operate with costly vacancies in these models, yet resist raising wages because pay would need to be increased for all workers, not just the incremental hired worker. And if employers collude to hold wages to a fixed below market rate, or monopsony power increases over time, then wages could remain stubbornly resistant to upward pressure, even at a time when the economy is booming. So with this framework as background, I'd like to make four observations about the labor market that I think are particularly relevant at a time when we're seeing relatively weak wage growth despite 50-year low unemployment. First, average wage growth is weaker than one would predict from historical relationships between wage growth and the unemployment rate. Janet Yellen alluded to this earlier this week and said that a leading explanation for the shift in the Phillips curve is that worker bargaining power is weaker than it used to be. Although nominal wage growth has been creeping up in this recovery, over the last 12 months, nominal wage growth has barely kept pace with inflation. There are many explanations for why wage growth may be weaker than we would predict. Low productivity growth, I think, is an important factor. But low productivity growth can't account for the last year because productivity growth has picked up, yet wage growth, real wage growth, has actually weakened. Based on the specification of the wage Phillips curve that I estimated 20 years ago in a Brookings paper, I would expect wages to be between 1 and 1.5% stronger today than they have been. Second observation. There's growing evidence supporting an important role of monopsony power in the job market, stemming from both employer concentration and dynamic labor market considerations. I won't go into too much detail on this work because one of the main contributors, Iona Marinescu, is here. But basically, this work finds that measures of employer concentration, either measured by concentration within an industry in a county or of employment within an industry in a county, and work by Ben Mellick and co-authors, or measured by job openings posted online for occupations within a small commuting zone, show a relationship with wages, which suggests that in more concentrated areas, wages are lower, other things being held equal. There's also some evidence that concentration has increased. Although, again, I think it's important that we define the boundaries of the labor market carefully in that work. Other studies have looked at monopsony power within specific industries. And here, I think the most work has been done in the nursing industry. Dan Sullivan in 1989, Doug Steger in 2010, and co-authors found substantial evidence that hospitals are able to use monopsony power in setting wages for nurses. Then lastly, there's evidence on dynamic monopsony power. For example, Doug Weber has used the longitudinal employer household dynamics data set to estimate labor supply elasticities to firms. Specifically, he looked at how turnover relates to the generosity of compensation across firms. He found that the average labor supply elasticity to a firm was 1.1. He also found considerable variability across firms. And the firms that had a more inelastic labor supply tended to pay lower wages, as one would expect, if they take advantage of their monopsony position. Third, monopsony power and search frictions have probably always existed in the labor market, but the forces that traditionally counterbalanced monopsony and boosted worker bargaining power have eroded in recent decades. The most obvious is labor unions. Union membership fell from 25% of the workforce in the U.S. in 1980 to 10.7% last year. Collective bargaining used to be an effective counterweight to monopsony power. We used to write papers on the union threat effect, but in most industries, there's hardly any union threat effect. So the spillover effects where companies might raise wages to try to prevent having a union drive is weaker than it used to be. Another counterbalance to monopsony power that is weaker today is the minimum wage. The US federal minimum wage is currently $7.25 an hour. It has not been raised since July of 2009. The real value of the minimum wage is down by about 20% since 1979. By contrast, in that period, Both the UK and Germany enacted their first national minimum wages, and they currently stand at $10 an hour at current exchange rates. The decline in unionization and the erosion of the real value of the minimum wage have been found to significantly contribute to higher income inequality and polarization in the US workforce. These shifts have also probably contributed to the downward trend in labor share in the US since the 1990s, after decades of stability. Now, one might argue that these changes to the labor market have made the labor market more competitive. But the fact that the employment to population rate has trended down, especially for the workers who were covered by collective bargaining and affected by the minimum wage, and that regional shocks are now more persistent for wages, employment, and labor force participation, suggests that we have a less competitive labor market with weaker bargaining power and more monopsony power. Fourth, there's been a proliferation of practices that enhance monopsony power and weaken worker bargaining power. I'll highlight five of these practices. First, there's been increased reliance on temporary help agencies, staffing firms, and outsourcing. One implication of this practice is that firms can wage discriminate. This can facilitate monopsony. If a hospital has persistently high vacancies for a nursing position, it can reach out to a staffing firm, hire a staff nurse from the firm, and pay a higher salary to that particular nurse than other nurses who are employed by the hospital. Second, a quarter of American workers are bound by a non-compete restriction on their current job or from a previous job. These restrictions, which may be justified in a limited number of cases to protect returns to specific training or trade secrets, have truly run amok. Even Jimmy John's used the practice for submarine sandwich makers until they were forced to drop it. Just over one in five workers who earn less than the median wage are bound by a non-compete restriction on their current or previous job, according to work that Eric Posner and I have done, and I'm sure we'll hear more about non-competes later from Evan Starr. Non-compete agreements reduce workers' options and reduce mobility and bargaining power. Third, a growing fraction of the workforce is covered by occupational licensing restrictions, typically imposed by state and local authorities. Morris Kleiner and I, for example, find that over a quarter of workers are required to obtain a license to perform their job. These restrictions may be justified in positions that require extraordinary skill or put the public at risk, but they also restrict job opportunities and mobility. Occupational licensing is also run amok. It's particularly difficult for workers who want to change jurisdictions, change states. It is especially a burden on military spouses. Military families move around often. The most common jobs for military spouses are nurses and teachers who often have to get licensed in the new state when they move, pay licensing fee, and by the time they are permitted to work in those states, they often move again. Fourth practice. My colleague Orly Ashenfelter and I have found that 58% of franchise companies have a no poaching clause in their franchise contract that prevents one franchisee from hiring workers from another franchisee or from the franchise company itself if the company operates stores. This is up from 36% of franchise companies in 1996. The practice is particularly common in fast food chains. We found that 80% of the largest quick service restaurant franchise chains had a no poaching requirement. Since the human capital that is being prohibited from moving around different outlets within the franchise would stay in the franchise company, it is awfully hard to see a business justification for this practice other than trying to suppress mobility and suppress workers' wages. Washington State took action. The Attorney General in Washington State launched an investigation and managed to persuade 30 of the largest franchise chains to drop their no-poaching agreement in the U.S., in Washington State and the U.S. Almost all of the major fast food companies with the no-poaching agreement have dropped that from their contract, thanks to the work of Bob Ferguson, the Attorney General in Washington State, over the last couple of months. Just yesterday, he announced that he's bringing a lawsuit against Jersey Mike's, franchise-based in my state, New Jersey, which operates in Washington State and other states, for continuing to use this practice. I should add that in addition to restricting mobility and increasing monopsony power, these types of restrictions on mobility, like non-compete clauses and no-poaching agreements, and the no-poaching agreement, which is completely blind to the worker. Workers are not aware. They're not party to these agreements. They reduce workers' opportunities for finding better job matches, improving their working conditions in other ways. And work by Bob Topel and Michael Ward back in 1992 found that about a third of the wage gains in the first 10 years of young workers' careers were associated with job changes. So apart from the effect of suppressing wages at the firm where these workers work, they also reduce opportunities for the workers to move up the wage hierarchy. Now, no-poaching agreements would clearly be illegal if they occurred across unrelated firms. It's an unsettled area of the law, as I understand it, if franchisees agree to these types of no-poaching agreements. But as I mentioned earlier, there are violations of the law outside outside of the franchise sector, as Adam Smith had anticipated. I could go through many examples, but I think I'm running short on time, so I'll just give you a few more. In the famous case, Apple, Google, Adobe, Intel, Intuit, Pixar, Lucasfilms were found to have colluded on not hiring each other's workers, colluding on pay setting, and paid $500 million settlement in 2015. There have been several cases in the hospital industry addressing pay of nurses. Eight major hospitals in Detroit recently reached a $90 million settlement in the suit alleging that the hospitals colluded to reduce nurses' pay. Similar cases are in various stages in Albany, Memphis, San Antonio, and Arizona. A couple of months ago, I spoke with Jeff Suri, who is a registered nurse and was the lead plaintiff in the Detroit nurses case. I wanted to understand from his perspective how he came to recognize that this was taking place and what impact it had on his career and his work. He said that he worked at the emergency room at St. John Providence Hospital in Warren, Michigan. He was hired in 1991. He later moved to the critical care unit and he tended patients who were recovering from open heart surgery and other serious conditions. After working there for 12 or 13 years, Mr. Suri said he got an inkling that the human resource department at his hospital was coordinating with other hospitals and setting nursing pay because he had an opportunity to see some emails where they were discussing trying to reduce mobility and coordinate on pay. He said the hospitals, or the nurses at his hospital were non-unionized, and the hospitals in the area wanted to prevent nurses from jumping from one hospital to another for better pay and better working conditions. The executives would often discuss these issues and exchange pay rates at conferences. One indication that the hospitals exploited their monopsony power that he told me about was that when they had vacancies, which was often, the hospitals would reach out to a staffing firm. The staffing nurses were paid $40 an hour, plus the firm got administrative fees, while employee nurses were paid $30 an hour. A class action suit was filed on behalf of Mr. Suri and thousands of other nurses in 2006. He gave a deposition in 2007. He said the hospital, quote, made life hell for me after that, increased his patient load to a level he considered unsafe for the patients. He quit in 2008. Other hospitals were reluctant to hire him. He now works in home health care. The antitrust suit was settled in 2010. Mr. Suri did not receive any compensation until 2012, 6 years after the suit was filed. So I think this gives an indication of the challenges that workers face in this situation and the retaliation that they sometimes can face. It's worth noting that collusion is easier when there are fewer firms in a market. The increase in employer concentration in the U.S. has probably facilitated collusion. And collusion doesn't have to be explicit. Employers could collude at a focal point. The minimum wage could be a focal point, for example. Round numbers could be a focal point. And there's evidence that this type of tacit collusion occurs as well. Now, a really tight labor market might make it possible for this collusion to break down. I suspect that's part of the reason for the historical Phillips curve to exist in the first place. So we may see some improvement if the economy continues to improve and the unemployment rate continues to stay low. I want to conclude by saying I presented a similar set of remarks at Jackson Hole this summer at the Kansas City Fed annual conference on monetary policy. The reaction I got was quite encouraging. I think many of the monetary policy officials thought these issues are important, but probably beyond the reach of monetary policy. I think there was a consensus coming out of that meeting that these are very important issues for the Department of Justice and for the FTC to focus on. I want to commend the FTC and the DOJ for issuing joint guidance in October of 2016 for human resource professionals, clearly stating that wage fixing and agreements not to poach other firms' workers are illegal. And I think this is an area that needs a greater attention and more vigilant enforcement, because from the evidence that is available, it seems that Adam Smith was right, and there are many instances of employers combining tacitly, sometimes explicitly, as in those emails that I read before, to try to suppress pay. Thank you.